Episode 33, let's go!
Welcome to the EMS Handoff, your source for all things EMS. And now, let's welcome to the show your hosts, Bradley Dean, Eric McCullough, and David Blevins.
Hello and welcome to the EMS Handoff Podcast. This is David, and along with my co-host, singular tonight, Bradley Dean, we are your source for all things EMS. Bradley, Eric has just abandoned us tonight. He said, got to go to a meeting. It's more important, you know, something about job versus fun. But we're going to try to make the muddle through this tonight with our distinguished guests that we're going to have. And the reference I like to use on this, we're going to go like the Replacements, Coach McGinty in the very last game. It's all about heart, and that's what we're hitting tonight. So, Bradley, how are things going over in North Carolina today?
Going great. Today was beautiful. This weekend we did our driving class, so a little bit of sun, so I had to dim the lights and do a few things so I didn't look too burnt.
Well, you know, I don't know how it was today, but yesterday is absolutely beautiful, and then today there was – you know, little scattered showers throughout. So we can't really complain a whole lot. It's just the way it goes. So we're going to go ahead since we do the roll call and Eric's still not here, you know, I just leaving out, you know, we won't mention him being gone again, except for later on, we'll mention him not here. But so we're going to go ahead and get started tonight. And so before we introduce our guests, we'd like to introduce our podcast partner, the Journal of Emergency Medical Services. Jim's been great partner to the EMS Handoff Podcast since our reboot from the Tidbit days, and we'd like you to go by and visit. So while the EMS Handoff remains your source for all things EMS and the podcast first, make sure and check out Jim's, who's been an industry leader for many years. In addition to that, you can go and check out all of our previous episodes, as well as our podcast partners out there as well. They've got several different hosts on there, so make sure and check out their shows as well. And don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review on their platforms there on Apple, Google, and Spotify. And don't forget, hey, Bradley, I've got it on today. They are here, our brand new podcast shirts. Make sure to go by and visit the Pursue Company, thepursueco.com/EMS handoff. And find our new podcast shirts. I got mine on today. They've got a great line for the EMS Handoff. In addition, they also support the Level 146 organization, which is there to stop human trafficking. Every time we get our monthly sales tracking with them, they've got a little line. And every purchase that you have goes directly to Level 146. So with all of that said, Bradley, let's get into that heart. Let's introduce that guest and get started.
Yes, sir. So tonight we've got Tom Boulier with us, who is a battalion chief of EMS for Hilton Head Fire and Rescue. And he's a member of the National Registry of EMTs Continued Competency Agenda Steering Committee, the NMSA's EMS Quality Improvement Committee, NENA's Telecommunicator CPR Working Group. He's an editorial advisor board member for EMS World and a content reviewer for the British Paramedic Journal. Previously, he's done a lot of work with cardiac stuff, high performance CPR with NHTSA, the Resuscitation Academy in South Carolina. He is a co-producer of the Co-STEMI web series and the editor of EMS12lead.com. Tom, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So the question is, what don't you do when it comes to the heart?
Well, I mean, I think most of what I do when it comes to the heart is in the pre-hospital wheelhouse. You know, a lot of it is 12-lead ECG interpretation, STEMI recognition, STEMI mimics, high-performance CPR and things like that. I mean, I do kind of take those topics to the next level, or I try to. But I try and keep it relevant and exciting and you know, make sure that it's applicable for what we do. It seems to me that paramedics are professionals, medical professionals, clinicians. And, you know, it's kind of important if you're going to be given drugs like amiodarone to know what you're looking at on the monitor.
So in all of our classes, we basically say the body was designed to keep two things alive. And, the very last things to go are the brain and the heart. And so let's go ahead and get into that. So first, you know, whenever we find somebody with the background that you have and their passion for that, what drew you to the heart? You know, why do you have such a focus in that area?
I think what first drew me was electrocardiography, because when I was in paramedic school, first I was working as a medical biller in a durable medical equipment company, and it was owned by a hospital. So when I was in paramedic school and I learned, you know, my 20 basic heart rhythms, I was able to transfer over to the hospital to the critical care step down unit and as a cardiac monitoring technician. So my job for a whole year was, you know, keeping an eye on, we were a very busy unit and we got patients from the CCU and the ICU and, you know, direct admits from, say, the emergency department. So, you know, I had 32 different patients' heart rhythms in front of me at all, you know, and that was my full-time job to keep an eye on those heart rhythms. And I'm a little bit of an autodidact, and it was a really interesting place. So if you saw an interesting heart rhythm, you could print it out and grab a cardiologist and they would come over and explain it to you. And I was just enthralled. I was fascinated with it. And so I took rhythm analysis to a really, really high level. In fact, I could do differential diagnosis of wide complex tachycardias way before I could identify STEMI, which is kind of a weird way to go about it. But that's where initially I got a passion for cardiology. And I think it all just kind of grew from there.
So let's go ahead and start. And I always like to start basically where you really think kind of the diving off point is, you know, starting off before we branch out into our conversation about the cardiac system, you know, where should we begin?
Well, that's an interesting question. I would say it depends on if you're teaching anatomy and physiology, or if you are teaching electrocardiography, or if you're teaching resuscitation. You can teach those topics separately. So I would say a good solid understanding of anatomy and physiology, not just, you know, how blood goes round and round, that sort of thing's important to learn the four chambers of the heart and the valves and things like that. But also I would say, just the basics of the SA node, the AV node, the Hisper-Kinji system, Bachman's bundle. And sometimes the problem is we leave out certain topics in our training and it leaves these like kind of Swiss cheese hole gaps in our knowledge. And sometimes no one ever comes in and fills those back in. So a perfect example of that would be like axis determination when you do 12 lead ECGs. That is a topic that terrifies people. But it's really not that difficult when taught properly. So, you know, if you kind of incorporate some of those things in the very beginning, but what I've come to understand is the reason a lot of us weren't taught those things in school is our instructors just didn't know them. And so one of the things that I've tried to do in my career is just kind of like, figure out, I remember what I was taught and what I wasn't taught. And so I enjoy going back and filling in those gaps at the very beginning as someone's kind of going through their career, kind of figuring out what they know and not spending too much time on the things they already have down pat, but trying to help them with the things that are going to help them take their own practice to the next level.
All right. So we're going to go ahead and take that right there. And really, I'm going to have you go through that AMP and ECG directly into resuscitation. So when you take a look and interact with the pre-hospital environment today, what do we see as kind of the deficiencies of knowledge, some of the Swiss cheese holes that you just mentioned. Other than access determination, that is certainly one that a lot of people need to hit. But where does that start? And then let's drive that directly into resuscitation and how the greater knowledge there can help us into resuscitation.
Sure. I mean, look, I'm a pragmatist. So I try and think like, well, what kind of calls do we go on where, you know, maybe what, 5% of our calls that are true, like maybe life-threatening emergencies where our actions or inactions could have a major impact on a patient. So I kind of look at those, you know, what do they need to know about bradycardias? You know, they need to be able to identify hyperkalemia. They need to be identify a high degree AV block. They need to be familiar with how to perform transcutaneous pacing and how to identify false capture versus true electrical capture on the ECG, things like that. And then with tachycardias, it's kind of deconstructing mythology like, well, this can't be sinus tachycardia because the rate's over 150, which is complete nonsense, but like almost everyone was taught that in school. And so, you know, you need to have sinus tachycardia as part of your differential diagnosis for many patients. And then, you know, it's just like, you know, from that point on, you try and just be a safe practitioner out there. Because most of the time, unless we are defibrillating a patient or on rare occasion, synchronized cardioversion, it's not that often that we really should be giving drugs like antiarrhythmics. And so a lot of being a good paramedic is knowing what not to do. And so that's a whole different level of critical thinking. And so, you know, just trying to get people, the irony of EMS is by the time you're really experienced enough to be out there delivering safe practice, your knees are bad. And, you know, you've got PTSD and you're wondering how much longer you're going to be able to carry people up and downstairs, you know? So I've always just like always emphasized expertly performed BLS as like the bedrock of what makes you a great EMS system or a really great paramedic. And then judiciously apply your ALS skills in a manner that is safe and helpful to patients and above all is not causing harm.
So you actually started to go directly into my next line right there. Anytime the ECC or American Heart Association, those come out with the new guidelines, one of the things that we commonly see, you know, I think one of the biggest ones over the last several years is that endotracheal intubation keeps going down further and further on their list of importance during a cardiac arrest event. And the argument becomes, because that's one of their advanced skills, we have to do that. You know, that is absolutely critical. So you made a comment there that I found very interesting. We all kind of give it the lip service in that conversation, like good BLS is what takes this into account. But I want to kind of rephrase this and get your opinion on it. Really, the lack of automatic use of some of these medications or electricity or endotracheal intubation or some of those advanced skills actually by automatically doing that, it actually lessens our abilities as paramedics. It's when we need to use those. It's that critical thinking. Am I kind of taking that right from what you said?
Sure. Because if you're going on clinical misadventures, then you're not helping your patient. You're probably not engaging in safe practice if you're not being thoughtful about it. Because, you know, to me, expertly performed BLS, it's definitely not a catchphrase. Like, we spend a lot of time on it. And a lot of what high performance CPR actually is perfecting rate, depth, recoil, ventilation, and perishock pause. It's very, very simple, but it's very, very important. And we want to like be able to do it very, very well. And if it's not working with a single rescuer, like you're holding your CE clamp and you're ventilating, but you still don't have a good seal, you can switch to two thumbs up and then someone else ventilate for you. So like, what is the first thing you should do when BLS is not working? Better BLS. You know, maybe that patient requires an OPA, bilateral NPAs, a two-handed mask seal, and someone else helping you ventilate. And depending on the type of emergency, if the patient has a pulse, but is not being properly ventilated and you're having a difficult time establishing that airway, but their sats are dangerously low. If that's all you accomplish on the call is properly oxygenating and ventilating that patient and getting their sats up, and you don't even get a blood pressure, but you arrive and that patient is properly oxygenated and ventilated at the hospital, they really shouldn't chastise you, because it's like ABC. No, I didn't get that far. I was still dealing with breathing and ventilation and oxygenation. These are the things that kill people in the pre-hospital setting. So I feel like we have to be like really mega expert level at making sure that people are properly oxygenated and ventilated. Sometimes, yes, that requires tracheal intubation, especially if they have a soiled airway or something like that. You might do a Jim Ducanto salad, you know, technique to decontaminate the airway and protect it with a tracheal tube. It's rare, but I think it can be life-saving when it's necessary. So we need the full armamentarium of all those skills, but we should also like escalate it as needed. And I, my approach to airway management is do the least invasive airway management that solves the problem safely for the patient and gets the job done, and prove it with pulse oximetry and with capnography, you know, because like we have to demonstrate that we're doing those things properly if we're doing it properly in 2021.
All right. So now that we're firmly in the resuscitation realm, let's go ahead and take off in that direction. Let's start with just our arrival and what information we should be collecting en route via dispatch and immediately upon scene to start that critical thinking process about what this patient needs.
Well, first of all, I'm totally stoked that you brought up dispatch, because our telecommunicators are definitely the unsung heroes of our 911 systems, and we will never be the best that we can be if we're not like this with our telecommunicators, because they have an extremely difficult job, because nobody calls 911 and says, come quickly, there's a sudden cardiac arrest here. That just doesn't happen. Okay. Someone's having a seizure. A guy fell down and hit his head. I think my uncle's having a stroke. They literally say everything, but there's a cardiac arrest. So this poor 911 telecommunicator that's not even there has to figure out what's going on, rapidly identify the fact that it's a cardiac arrest, so that they can go straight to rapid dispatch and start telecommunicator CPR instructions. If they don't get that piece right, there's going to be no pulse point push notification. There's going to be no pre-arrival CPR. So that's all incredibly important. And they've got their hands full. Most of these dispatchers are understaffed, underpaid, and we're asking the impossible. And a lot of times they haven't been given the training and the tools that they deserve to be able to do their job to the best of their ability. So thank you for bringing that up, because that is a super, super important part of our overall EMS system that just does not get discussed nearly enough. So hopefully we're going to, you know, we'll be lucky if we get an age and a location and just notification that it might be a cardiac arrest. I mean, but they're doing all this other stuff that they have to do. Then I, in my mind, they've done their job brilliantly.
So once you get that information, what information that you do get, you know, we go en route and typically with those, you know, you may get, if you have a fire first response, you may have law enforcement go with you. So you show up, you know, you go through all the basics, you know, making sure the scene is safe. And then we really need to start to guide into what is going on with that patient. So what are the first things that you see when coming up to that patient?
Well, one thing that I've seen many times is that it's not always so easy to tell that somebody's in cardiac arrest, okay? Because they can have those anoxic seizures at the moment of collapse, and they can have their abnormal breathing. That is confusing for bystanders. It's confusing for telecommunicators. And I have seen it be confusing for first arriving EMTs and paramedics. Okay. And so they're spending way too much time doing this. And the patient's kind of like guppy breathing. And they're like, is that a pulse? I'm not sure. What I would say is, if an adult has collapsed, they are unconscious, and there is a deviation from normal breathing, you know, what we do is we power on the monitor, start a pulse check. And by the time it makes that little noise that lets you know that it's booted up, you're making your decision. And we're erring on the side if we're going into high performance CPR, because soon enough, the pads and things are going to be on, and you're going to have a heart rhythm. You're going to have a capnography reading. You're going to have more information to help you. But I actually have seen pre-arrival like video. Okay. Like people from their cell phones, where our staff has arrived on scene, and these patients survived. Okay. By the way, but you can tell because the person was in V-fib, but you could see them kind of, you know, gasping for air. And so, you know, you look at it after, not mad at them. I guess it could happen to anybody, but I think this is one of the important points, that the Seattle King County Resuscitation Academy stresses so much. It's measure and improve. You've got to look at your performance, and you have to give that feedback in a non-punitive way. So that we can always learn. You got to always be learning from not your mistakes. It's things that you probably could have been better. You didn't recognize that it was a problem, but now we know. So we're going to give that feedback back to the crew so that they can improve their performance. So I would say, first thing arriving on scene, if you can tell that it is a life-threatening emergency and the patient's unconscious and there's a deviation from normal breathing and they look like crap, don't delay. If it's not obvious that they have a pulse, start compressions and begin your process. I would say the same thing for a suspected opioid overdose, by the way. Is there anything more frustrating than six rescuers arriving on scene? Someone is unconscious and breathing 4 or 5 times a minute, and a bunch of people are standing around and somebody's spraying naloxone up their nose. For God's sake, man. Start ventilating that patient, put them on pulse oximetry, and be methodical and take your time, but be useful, you know, address the problem. They're not breathing adequately. We can fix that while we're doing other things like starting an IV before we give the naloxone. So I would just say, let the process play out, let the system work, and err on the side of implementing your high performance CPR, your PIC crew CPR, whatever process you have, let it start. That would be my first bit of advice. Get it going.
So you make a very valid point that a lot of times people come up and the first thing they do is they spend a lot of time on pulse checks. And as we know, going with some of those new guideline updates over the years, you know, that pulse check should only be 10 seconds and we need to start on those compressions. And really, they've come pretty close to saying, if you're not sure, just start chest compressions. The concern in years past was R&T phenomenon, and you know, the evidence never really supported that. It was a possibility, but I don't know if anybody ever actually captured anybody causing an R&T by starting CPR. So really, you do a chest compression. If they turn around and go, ow, that hurts, you know, you need to stop. But you're already starting and getting that high quality CPR. Now, you may mention a couple of things when we're talking. Let's just talk again, those basics, and kind of drive home the point. You talked depth, rate, and recoil. So why are those important?
Well, we have good data from this, and it's not all just from animal studies. Those three variables work together to really make a perfect chest compression. So if you're compressing at a rate of about 110, and if you're going 5 to 6 centimeters, or, you know, 2 to 2.5 inches, and if you're allowing full recoil, that is critically important because you're pulling that tiny little vacuum at the upstroke that allows that blood return. And you get those three things going well. we know that we can have a prolonged resuscitation. You can almost stop the dying process. And you can resuscitate that patient. Some data shows up to maybe an hour, and they can still survive neurologically intact at hospital discharge. So if we're doing letter perfect CPR, then we are perfusing the brain well enough that we can keep it alive while we're getting that heart restarted. So one of the reasons that outcomes in places like Seattle are excellent is they have taken the science of doing perfect CPR to the next level. I had no idea the degree to which they had perfected CPR. As a matter of fact, I almost didn't attend their high performance CPR train the trainer event because I thought I knew it all. We already were doing pit crew CPR, and I already knew about the problem of allowing full recoil, but I had never trained on an instrumented mannequin before. And it turned out that I was leaning on the chest a little bit and not allowing full recoil. So now when I allow full recoil, I actually take the heel of my hand all the way off the chest. So you, like you could swipe a credit card underneath the heel of my hand on the upstroke. And that's how I teach it too, to my staff. So, I mean, rate, depth, and recoil, that's the trifecta. You do those three things right, you're going to be doing some very good CPR.
And, you know, we also take a look at that evidence, and whenever we take a look, you know, ultimately we're priming that pump for the electricity, you know, all the subsequent actions that we end up taking. But we know that if we were to try to attach the electricity and go with a shock, and that heart's not primed because we don't have that good CPR, it's not really going to take effect and ultimately become detrimental. We need that highly oxygenated blood that is coming to and preparing so that it can restart.
Well said. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. You're exactly right about that.
And, you know, we see the times with those evidence as well that, you know, they fall rapidly without good CPR, but we return to that and you can actually bring those numbers back up. And anecdotally, this is one of those that's interesting while I'm still in the field. I love to use this example, and the individual that did it would be embarrassed to know that I'm speaking about him. But, you know, before we really got to the point that adult CPR needed to be at 100 compressions, a minimum of 100 compressions, rate of 100 a minute, he came up with the idea and said, hey, based on everything I see, if I go fast and deep, then I should have better results. And one of the first calls after that, man, he did. And he was getting about 110 to 120. And believe it or not, she was up and talking to the crews without an advanced airway, without medications, as soon as we loaded her into the ambulance. And she was discharged 3 days later. And you know, the only thing that I could say is that he did what you said is, you know, it wasn't quite there for her, but, you know, that good quality CPR. So let's talk about some of the other things that we tend to see when we're talking about cardiac arrest and management and resuscitation. The fact that we just need to dump a large amount of drugs into them, D50, Narcan, all this different stuff because you're not sure. So we just want to load them up and go to town. So what's some things that are still prevalent in the field but probably need to be pulled back?
Well, I mean, we're debating whether or not we should be using epinephrine right now, and that kind of goes back and forth. I think we can over-focus on this controversy. To me, I sometimes joke around, this is fiddling while Rome burns. Like, we're having problems. Maybe like we haven't optimized our telecommunicator CPR. Maybe we're not practicing rapid dispatch. We haven't optimized high-performance CPR. And the basics of all these other things. But my God, we like to argue about drugs and epinephrine and things like that. What we did is we cut our epinephrine dose to 0.5 milligrams and a maximum of 6 doses. So we max out at 3 milligrams. That's just kind of the choice that we made. I'm aware of systems that do not use any epinephrine for shockable. They only use epinephrine for non-shockable. You know, there's a trial that was done that showed no improvement in neurointact survival with epinephrine. So, you know, the truth is we don't know. Is there any really good evidence for epinephrine? There's really not. There's really no good evidence for any drug, routine use of any drug in cardiac arrest. Obviously, if you suspect hyperkalemia, I think you should give calcium. Now, naloxone, there are some very passionate people that are adamant that you do not ever give naloxone. It is just not a cardiac arrest drug. Well, you know, remember the beginning where I was saying, if you're not sure, start CPR. And the guidelines are consistent with this also. I actually, it doesn't bother me in the slightest. If somebody thinks that it's, you know, people say, well, okay, well, now you've given naloxone. Couldn't you have just worked the cardiac arrest, intubated them, and like, did the naloxone save their life? It's like, well, no, but if you could have a conscious talking patient, why wouldn't you want that? Like, to me, it seems logical that you would want that. But you know, to all of you out there right now that are saying, I can't believe he just said that, fine, don't give it then. Perfect. The way we do it is we err on the side of hitting them with the kitchen sink. So if we get there and you're unconscious and you're breathing abnormally, like four times a minute, something like that, and we think it's an overdose and we don't detect a pulse, we're going to start high performance CPR. Once the pads are attached and we have IV or IO access, we may give you some naloxone, because if you have the ability to wake up, we would prefer that you do that. We have good results with that. Maybe somebody else doesn't agree. That's fine. So should we stop doing it? I don't know. I think that's a judgment call. But remember, I want people to be out there using their, you know, that muscle between their ears too. We need to think about what is causing this cardiac arrest, because it used to be only for asystole and PEA. You would get to the end of the algorithm and then your instructor would say, is there anything else? And you say, oh yeah, I'd consider the H's and T's. What the AHA has done now is that's at the top. Okay. The very first thing you do is consider the H's and T's. Okay. And then from there you go on. And even then they're telling you, well, we're going to start an IV. We're going to give oxygen. We're going to properly ventilate. So you're already taking care of hypoxia because you're properly ventilating that person. You're starting the line. You're going to give fluids. So if the patient's hypovolemic, you're taking care of that problem. So, you know, they're kind of baking into the cake, like, what are the most obvious things that could have you in a non-shockable cardiac arrest? And we're correcting those things like right out of the gate. If it's shockable, it's different. You're going to get shocked right away. We're going to start high-performance CPR. You're going to get defibrillated. You may end up getting antiarrhythmics. But even that, I would say, before we give amiodarone in my system, you will have been shocked five times and we will have changed the shock vector before we give you an antiarrhythmic like that. Because so frequently the problem is we don't have optimal pad placement, and very, very frequently fixing that problem, you will get the patient back on the next defibrillation attempt. So I would encourage folks to think about their shock vector as well and not always assume that amiodarone is going to solve that problem. But again, my system emphasizes expertly performed BLS. It doesn't mean that they're not allowed to give drugs. Doesn't mean they're not allowed to intubate. They are allowed to do those things, but our emphasis is always, always, always on the basics.
Now, leading up to this, we were kind of talking, so I'm going to toss up the softball here that a lot of people think that one of the key things that you have to do is to check a blood sugar. Is that, where is that in your level of importance?
Not even on the register. Like, I've seen it done. I'd say the only time in my entire career that I think any benefit came from checking a blood sugar was a unwitnessed asystolic arrest of a known diabetic in the community that we had been to many times. They assessed the blood sugar and it read high. And we reasoned because of that, that there may have been a potassium shift. And so we kind of treated for hyperkalemia and then we ended up getting a pulse back, but I really don't know what the lab values were, but you can at least see that there was a clinical rationale versus us thinking that hypoglycemia is a reversible cause of cardiac arrest. So let's check a blood sugar so we can give D50. It's just, I can't say it never happens in my system. It may, but it would be rare, very, very rare. It's just not a routine practice for us.
With that, what is your ideal setup? So if you were to go in, a lot of people, when they come in, because your focus or your emphasis has been on that BLS side, having good high performance CPR, you know, everybody wants to take in everything. They have a 50 pound first in bag, cardiac monitor, the you know, they may have a Lucas or an auto pulse, the stretcher, et cetera. You know, what, coming in, we've recognized, we've done our pulse check, we've started the CPR. You know, if you had the things that you needed right there on the top, what are your key things that you want them to have readily available?
The most important would be the defibrillator. The second most important thing would be the airway bag. So we actually, and then I guess if I had to pick a third thing, it'd be a suction unit. And then, you know, the maybe a combined like drug box and IO kit, something like that for vascular access and to give medications. But our second new company also brings a backup defibrillator, an airway bag, and a backup suction unit. So we make those pieces of equipment redundant, but there is no requirement that we bring the stretcher or a backboard to the scene of a cardiac arrest. We send you know, a medic, two engines, and a battalion chief to every suspected cardiac arrest. So we have enough manpower to send somebody to go get, you know, the stretcher while we're doing our post-resuscitation care checklist or something like that. So it's just not something that we generally bring to the patient's side at the beginning.
With that, because the way it's sounding, and I please correct me if I'm wrong, it's sounding like your all's goal is moving to what a lot of services are either on the fence to, maybe on the process of going, y'all are working cardiac arrest on scene. Is that right? You're not doing and then moving straight to the ambulance.
100% definitely working it on scene. I think it is a huge disservice to our patients to, unless there is a compelling reason, I think you should work them where they lay. That could be the 50-yard line of a Friday night football game. it doesn't matter. Or in the middle of a restaurant, I don't care. If someone's in cardiac arrest, they own that place until we're done. And so unless they're on hot pavement that's burning their back, or you're on top of a fire ant mound, or there's bullets flying, there are legitimate reasons to move a patient. But I think our routine practice 100% should be working them where they lay.
And just out of curiosity, what does Hilton Head and your all's protocol say as far as your I guess really kind of minimum time limit to do that? Are you all have a kind of an end time already pre-designated, or is it just based on every individual patient?
There is no specific time, and people used to think that it was 20 minutes. And, you know, a couple of times I'd say like, well, is there any reason you terminated this code at 20 minutes? I mean, you had a good end-tidal CO2, the patient, you know, you still had an organized rhythm on the monitor. Well, aren't we supposed to, you know, terminate at 20 minutes? It's like, no, our protocol never said that, but that was our practice. And that was one of those things that was passed along from paramedic to paramedic. So we had to kind of deconstruct that. And, you know, a friend of mine from Wake EMS likes to say 40 is the new 20. I do think that around the 40 minute mark, you ought to consider the possibility of loading for transport. If you have a youngish patient with a good story. And you know what I mean? It's like, there's times we'll get somebody back and maybe even get a 12 lead ECG that might show LAD occlusion, but then they rearrest, and then we get them back and they rearrest again. At some point, you need to start thinking about moving that to the hospital. We do own a Lucas device. We do not use it as part of our routine resuscitation strategy, but a situation like that, I think, is probably the best use case I can think of for mechanical CPR.
Well, and I've heard some locations that had made the decision that their initial CPR management was manual compressions. And if they were to get an organized rhythm back, that's when they would initiate their transport, and they would put the device on at that point in time. Mm-hmm. In the event that they rearrested, as you said, in the back of the ambulance on the way to the hospital, you know, limited staffing and such. So one of the things that a lot of, our field crews have issue with when going towards this is the fact that, you know, most families, bystanders, et cetera, say, you know, the ambulance's job is to transport to the hospital. And if we're staying there, we're keeping them from actually getting what they need. That is a really kind of a PR and a community education program. So when you all went to that, were you around when your service went to that? And how did you address some of those concerns when you started that field termination protocol?
Well, there's two sides to this. One is whether or not you work the cardiac arrest on scene. And the second is how and when you terminate on scene. So to take the first, yes, I was there when we started working these cardiac arrests on scene. We had no problem. We had no problem whatsoever. I'll never forget this interview we did. I think it was in Guilford County, North Carolina. And there was interviewing the spouse of a cardiac arrest survivor, and she said something really interesting. She said, "I don't know nothing about medicine, but I could tell that they were competent." And I was like, interesting. Like, when you really have it together and you come in. And another comment, a woman named Leslie Pitt, who is the spouse of one of our cardiac arrest survivors, said in an interview that she felt like a military special forces team had come into her bedroom, you know. So they know when you know what you're doing, and they are glad that their loved one is getting expert help. And that has been our experience. I can't think of maybe once or twice, but it would have been like a shooting or God knows what. I mean, there are circumstances, of course, where people have like, what are you waiting for? Go to the hospital. But most of the time, even pediatrics, and that's a lot harder because we do now stay and attempt resuscitation right there on scene, even with a baby. Okay. That you can imagine someone being like, go, go, go. And the paramedic being like, yeah, let's go. I'm terrified. Let's get it going. No, man, you got to throttle that instinct back. And, you know, we use the hand tevi system, so we can have that pre-arrival conversation because, I mean, how would you know that a 4-year-old was Braslow White, right? You wouldn't know that. Right. So you're terrified all the way to the scene, not knowing what you're going to do. But if you know it's a 5-year-old and you can go, okay, 1, 3, 5, that's 10, 15, 20. Okay. There's a 20 kilogram kid, move the decimal. I'm going to be given 2 milliliters of Epi 1 to 10,000. So I already know my cardiac arrest dose, and you can already, so you're rolling on scene. You know which BVM you're going to use. You know what size OPA you're going to use, you know what size pads you're going to use, you know what size IO you're going to use, and you know what your first cardiac arrest dose is. You know a lot, and you can assign those responsibilities. And so if you arrive on scene and you start effectively ventilating even a child, and you get effective chest compressions, rate, depth, recoil, boom, you've just implemented the most important evidence-based therapy for that child that is drowned in a swimming pool. just by throttling your emotions back a little bit. But we send enough people, including a battalion chief, that they can kind of be a family liaison and educate and be like, absolutely, we're going to be getting to the hospital in a minute. But first, you know, we're going to do this high quality CPR. We're going to make sure your child is properly ventilated. We're going to get some really important medications on board. And then in a very orderly manner at that point, then we're going to transfer to the hospital. But don't worry, everything that is supposed to be happening is happening right now. We're right here with you, right by your side. We're going through this together. They know when you know what you're doing. They do. They know.
Well, let's change up this conversation just a little bit. I'm going to toss it over to Bradley. We're going to get into a little bit going really kind of back to the beginning and talking a little bit about telecommunicators. So Bradley.
So one of the things that I think is really interesting is having telecommunicators to be able to recognize agonal respirations on the phone. Because if you look at it, if somebody goes into cardiac arrest, seen or heard, and they can get hands on the chest, the sooner the better. Because if they're waiting until first responders or EMS gets theirs, that's 6 minutes to 10 minutes into the cardiac arrest, chances of survival have dropped significantly. So how do you, or what have you done in your community to be able to improve them being able to recognize that, so you increase getting hands on the chest?
Excellent question. So I think that we've done a real disservice to a couple generations of folks that we have taught CPR. Because we've told them, for example, to get an AED, you have to be unconscious and not breathing. Well, that's kind of a problem. This is why you sometimes see an athlete on the basketball court. You got, you know, a coach with their fingers in the poor kid's mouth, and there's an AED right there, but no one's using it because of this agonal breathing problem. So I think that no-go should be taught at all levels, from heart saver CPR class, telecommunicators, professional rescuers. I don't care who you are. And that is, like, when someone suddenly collapses, you know, we should ask, are they conscious? No, we've got our first no. Are they breathing normally, with emphasis on normally? No, you've got your second no. Then go. Start CPR, get the AED. When the AED arrives, power it on and follow the voice prompts. If we taught it that way to everybody, we would have a lot more success. But a lot of people are afraid to do CPR. They're afraid they're going to hurt somebody. In reality, what happens is our 911 telecommunicators are able to elucidate very quickly whether or not CPR is needed by ramping up to CPR quickly. One of the most comical recordings at the Seattle King County is you hear this dispatcher doing no-no-go. And so you hear, like, you know, King County 911, you know, what's the location of your emergency, something like that. And they say, or what's your emergency? Yeah, I can't wake up my husband. Okay. Is he breathing normally? No, he's snoring. All right, ma'am, we're going to do CPR. I need you to get him on the floor. We are? Yes, ma'am, we need to do CPR. You got to get him on the floor. Then you hear this voice say, Harold, get on the floor. I'm going to do CPR on you. And then you hear this voice say, what the hell for? You know? So just because you're ramping up quickly and making the decision quickly doesn't mean, number one, that the CPR is ever going to actually have to be given. Or if you start doing the compressions, and I think David said it, and someone pushes your hands away, well, guess what? They're not in cardiac arrest. You've just discovered something really important. So I think there was one study, I think it was a combination. It was Seattle and London, and like 880 consecutive patients that received this no-no-go process. Like, the question is, was anyone harmed? Was anyone that was not in cardiac arrest harmed? One patient, and it wasn't from chest compressions. An elderly woman had her hip broken when she was dragged from the bed to the floor to do the chest compressions. It broke her hip. But none of the patients were harmed by chest compressions. So if it turns out that they're postictal from a seizure or hypoglycemic or some other thing or an opioid overdose, it certainly appears that getting injured from telecommunicator CPR is rare, but we know that it can be life-saving. So it's just a good strategy.
All right. So with knowing that it's a good strategy, I guess one of the big things is how did you train the telecommunicators to be able to do that? Did you have a program or audio recordings that were used?
Sure. So, I mean, a lot depends on what your emergency medical dispatch protocols are. Sometimes you have wide latitude to change those protocols, and the medical control physician can just say, we're going to do it this way going forward. Others are a little bit more structured, but you can get to the same result. For example, instead of saying no, no, go, you could think when you know you go, for example. Like sometimes they want to say, well, are they breathing? They want to say that first. But the reality is, we do a lot of over-verification in the 911 center. And we ask a lot of unnecessary questions and we ask a lot of redundant questions. Sometimes that can be as simple as they're multitasking and they're trying to type something into the computer and you've already said to them something that matters that's going to trigger their next thought, but they need to buy a couple seconds and they might say again, so he's not breathing at all right now. Like they'll repeat or kind of echo something back to the 911 caller, but in reality, they're just trying to complete a task like typing in an instruction or dispatching a unit. It is extremely complicated what they have to do. So it can be either way. Peter Antevi down in South Florida has had great success taking it upon himself to directly deal with 911 telecommunicators. Same with Deschutes County, which is where Bend, Oregon is. They've done a great job with their telecommunicators. What we actually did on Hilton Head Island is we partnered with RQI Partners and Julie Buckingham, who's a faculty member with Seattle King County Resuscitation Academy, has a product called RQIT. The T stands for telecommunicator CPR. And they put our telecommunicators through an initial training program so that they kind of understand the why of everything. And they do simulations and they do coaching and they listen to all of the 911 calls that from our CARES cases, and our staff get individual feedback. And it's dispatcher to dispatcher. So they basically have a coach that listens to their 911 calls and gives them feedback. And like quarterly, they have to solve different problems. Like a couple quarters ago, they had to walk a 911 caller through using an AED, for example. Or another one, you know, it goes out as a, you know, maybe like you have to solve an uncooperative caller. Another time, maybe it's abnormal breathing. So we actually have purchased a special training program to assist them. And they've told me it's some of the best training they've ever had. So, you know, they deserve it. They have an incredibly difficult job, and the tasks that they have to perform are extremely complicated. And I kind of like too that it's dispatcher training dispatcher. So like Tom Boothelet, EMS chief, doesn't have to go into their domain and tell them how to be a dispatcher. That probably would go over like a lead balloon. I don't know. About as well as them coming into the back of an ambulance and telling a paramedic what to do. So I kind of like this approach that Julie has. Where it's dispatchers helping dispatchers.
All right. So before we get into the point of wrapping up, I know you mentioned it just a little bit earlier in the call tonight, but talk a little bit about the Resuscitation Academy and some other things that our field crews, whether they're EMTs, advanced EMTs, or paramedics, can do to kind of spin up even more on some of the new evidence-based medicine that's going on and making sure that they're taking care of these resuscitation calls as best they can.
Well, first and foremost, I'm a big fan and student of the Seattle King County Resuscitation Academy. So I'm lucky in that I got to attend their leadership program in Seattle, not once, but twice. Very few people have been able to do that. I've also been to their alumni event. And then I was able to host the South Carolina resuscitation, and they were generous enough to support that. So they sent one of their physicians, Dr. Peter Kudenchuk, and a couple of high-performance CPR instructors. And that helped my department make sure that all of our HP CPR instructors were trained by the very best. And so that I looked at that as almost like a DNA transfer from them to my department, for which I'm very grateful. And then I've gone on to help support the Florida Resuscitation Academy, and I've done some stuff in Atlanta, Georgia as well. I would just say that there's a lot of resources available at the Resuscitation Academy website. They have a YouTube channel. You can, where they will show you two rescuer, three rescuer, maybe four rescuer. I don't remember, but they have all these different kind of like, modules to show you how high performance CPR, the Seattle way, is kind of, accomplished. And all of that is free. They also have various toolkits for things like telecommunicator CPR, even for things like terminating resuscitations on scene. They're a wealth of information. They're very generous, and they're just some of the best people and some of the best professionals that I've ever had the pleasure of working with. So I appreciate you asking about that. If you want to go to the Seattle King County Resuscitation Academy, I would say that priority will probably be given to you if you can bring like your EMS chief, your medical control physician, and your 911 communications like manager, and then maybe a training officer or something like that. If you can send a delegation of decision makers there, then you're probably going to go to the front of the line, because they want you to go back to your system and implement the core strategies to drive maximum impact. That said, you know, they are really great about answering questions. They're doing better with their social media presence and things like that. So I would definitely encourage anybody that is interested to connect with them for sure. And then as far as evidence-based practice, again, you know, with the emphasis on expertly performed BLS, I would just say, train with instrumented mannequins. Train with instrumented mannequins, because that is how you get objective feedback of your performance. So when you think about high performance CPR, you've got your individual skills. That is how you, as an individual, how are your chest compressions? How are your ventilations? But then putting that in a team setting and try, okay, now we're going to do 30 and two. I'm going to do the compressions. Now you're going to do the ventilations, and then bring in that third person. Okay. And I'm going to defibrillate. And now we're going to swap out the rescuer on chest compressions during the perishock pause. Once you can orchestrate it to that level, in a training environment, at least, then you've achieved what we call high performance CPR. Your next step is to take it out there into the field and try it. And then look at your monitor download and look at your compression rate. Look at your perishock pause. Look at your CPR fraction time and see if there's anything in there that you could have done better. Oh, that patient was in VFib for 3.5 minutes and we didn't shock him. Oh, we had a perishock pause of 15 seconds right there. I wonder what was going on. Or, oh, geez, that's when somebody intubated. That's a 30-second pause of compressions right there. We probably ought not have done that, you know, and then start giving that non-punitive feedback back to the crews. And then celebrate your wins. You were telling me about a call where a partner of yours did excellent CPR and the woman was awake and talking in the back of the ambulance. How freaking awesome is that? Our youngest cardiac arrest survivor in 2016 was a 21-year-old woman that is living her best life in Hawaii right now. That's awesome. She's gone on to get married to her boyfriend, who was a United States Marine. She attended the Marine Corps ball, and now they're a happy married couple. And I see them on Facebook sometimes and Instagram, and I'm like, wow, we gave that young lady her life back. How incredible. What she does with it is up to her. But I can't think of much more. What is more sacred? What is more gratifying than giving someone their life back when they have so much life left to live? So don't forget to celebrate those wins too, because that's really important. That's how it really gets in your DNA, is when the survivors start to have that relationship, not just with the crew that resuscitated with them, but also the people that perform the bystander CPR. That's when you bring it full circle, and your department will never go back to the way it used to be.
Well, Tom, we want to certainly thank you. There's a lot of stuff that you gave our listeners tonight. So go ahead and give us your final thoughts on resuscitation, cardiac arrest management, cardiac system in general. Give us your last thoughts.
Hey, Rome wasn't built in a day, you know. Certain things like joining a cardiac arrest registry, like the CARES registry, it can be complicated. Contracts with hospitals take a while. I guess my advice would be get started. We used to train how to swap out the rescuer on chest compressions during the perishock pause using couch cushions in the day room at the fire station. You know, get creative and just start thinking about what if you went on a cardiac arrest today with a one-year-old, what would you do? Would you be ready for that? You know, and if not, then think about what size OPA you would use. And then that's one thing that you'll always remember, you know, what size OPA you would give for that one-year-old. You can start small, do something achievable. You know, those little incremental gains add up. And I would just say there's, you never have to wait to start getting better as an individual. But then the system has to put skin in the game too. We cannot be our best as individual practitioners within a dysfunctional system. So fight the good fight and do what you can. Go to the meetings, even if you don't like them, and speak up and see what you can do to start getting those system level improvements as well. The two have to go hand in hand.
Excellent. Thank you for that. Hey, Bradley, what do you have?
So one of the things I will say is it's not complicated, but it isn't easy. So Tom laughs because that's one of the things that I heard when I went to the Resuscitation Academy is do it step by step. You know, find one thing, get the low-hanging fruit. Improving telecommunicator CPR is probably one of the easiest things. I can't teach 160,000 people in our community CPR. I can teach 38 people how to recognize agonal respirations and get hands on chest. So that's a low-hanging fruit. Find out what's there for you and take care of it in your community.
Well said.
All right, gentlemen. Tom, again, thank you for taking the time out this evening and sharing your insight and your passion for cardiac arrest management and resuscitation and all the techniques that you shared here tonight. Certainly going to be a great handoff to the community. So as we end this episode, we always like to thank our podcast partner again. Jim's has been great. Don't forget to go by their podcast platforms on Apple, Google, or Spotify. Subscribe, rate, and review. Let them know what you think about us and the EMS handoff. Also, make sure you find your way over to YouTube. Hit the like and subscribe button as well. Let us know what you're thinking there. And always go to our website, emshandoff.com. Don't forget to go by the Pursuit Company. Find our new shirts out there as well. And just from my co-hosts, Eric McCullough, who's missing tonight. I told you we would only mention it one other time. And Bradley Dean, this is David. Take care, stay safe, and always remember the value of your EMS handoff.